This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Broadcast reports in Britain say that police arrested one of the men suspected of trying to set off bombs on London's transport system last week. We'll bring you an update on the investigation in a few moments. But our larger focus today is on how police respond to the threat of suicide bombers. As the first wave of attacks in London vividly demonstrated, the threat is very real, as is the risk involved in responding to it. The day after last week's failed attacks, British police followed a man they believed to be a suspect into a subway station, chased him onto a subway car, and shot him 7 times in the head. It turned out that the man was an electrician from Brazil, and police now admit he had nothing to do with the bomb plot. To the surprise of many Londoners, it turns out that British police adopted a shoot-to-kill policy earlier this year after deciding that the only way to deal with a suspected suicide bomber is to kill him instantly. Despite last week's mistake, the policy stands. Metropolitan Police Commissioner Ian Blair speaking with Sky TV.
This is not a Metropolitan Police policy, it's a national policy. And I think we're quite comfortable that the policy is right, but of course these are fantastically difficult times. I mean, I think we have to concentrate on, take this tragedy, deeply regret it, and move on.
How should police deal with the threat of suicide bombers? We'll look at the reaction in Britain. We'll also ask about policy in this country. What's appropriate? What's legal? Who decides? Later in the program, the investigation into the leak of a CIA agent's identity may be wider than we previously thought. But first, the police response to suicide bomb suspects. What's reasonable? If you're a police officer, what are you trained to do? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is NPR's Rachel Martin. She's been following the London bombings and the investigation. She's with us from our studios in London. Rachel, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure. Hi, Neil.
Do we have any confirmation that one of the men arrested today in Birmingham, a city in the Midlands of England, was one of the men suspected of carrying out last week's attempted attacks?
Police have not yet come forward and confirmed this. There is a press conference that they're scheduled to have. We're waiting for that confirmation. In the meantime, British television is reporting that 24-year-old Yassin Hassan Omar was arrested in one of two raids on houses this morning in Birmingham, which is about 100 miles northwest of London. Local police, anti-terrorist officers, and security services conducted raids on two houses in the early hours of the morning today. Hassan Omar was detained in a house in the Haymills area of Birmingham. Local residents there say roads were closed off and a helicopter hovered around overhead during the raids, and about 100 homes were evacuated. Witnesses said they heard police shouting the man's name, Hassan, Hassan. He reportedly was wearing a backpack similar to the one worn by the suspected attackers in last week's bombings. Police were so concerned about that backpack that they threw it out the window. The police had to use a taser to detain the man. He resisted arrest, and they used the taser to bring him into custody. And they then took him to Paddington Green, which is a high-security police station in London where terrorism suspects are usually questioned. Again, Omar is suspected of being the man who attempted to set off a bomb at Warren Street Tube Station last Thursday in London.
He's 24 years old. What else do we know about him?
Well, we know he's a Somali and that he came to Great Britain with his family as a refugee in the early 1990s from East Africa. Both Hassan Omar and the other named suspect, 27-year-old Mukhtar Saeed Ibrahim, have been legal residents of Britain for the past 10 years. Hassan Omar has been linked to the apartment that authorities raided on Monday in North London. He's been living there since about 1999. Neighbors there identified him, and they also said that Ibrahim visited the apartment often. Neighbors also said that they had spotted Omar back at that flat the day after the Thursday attacks. That would be Friday. And neighbors say people were coming and going from that apartment at all hours of the day and night. And at one point, there were apparently 50 cardboard boxes delivered to the apartment When neighbors asked what was in them, they were told it was paint stripper. Police are still scouring this apartment. It's been a focal point of the investigation. They're looking for evidence that could lead them to the other suspected bombers.
Yassin Hassan Omar was, as you mentioned, one of four men arrested in Birmingham today. The other three are still in Birmingham. But there were also raids on houses in London. Two men picked up on a train. This is going all sorts of places.
It is. It's a very quickly developing investigation. As you said, three other men were detained, arrested in Birmingham. They're still there. And another man was briefly detained at Luton Airport today, which is north of London. He was taken off a flight to France by armed officers, and then he was released soon afterwards. Police today also obtained extension orders to continue questioning two of the four men arrested on Friday and over the weekend in London. Also today, we saw the first photographs of the aftermath of the fatal July 7th bombings. These photographs were broadcast on ABC News, and they showed the wreckage inside the train near King's Cross. That's the train on which the bomber, German Lindsay, killed himself and 26 others. We've also received some new information about Mukhtar Saeed Ibrahim. He's the other bomber who was named by authorities earlier this week. This man is said to have a police record. He served 3 years in prison for mugging people at knife point in 1996. Saeed Ibrahim's family has come forward. They've made a point of saying that this man is not a close family member. He's been estranged from them. They say they denounce all acts of terrorism, and they're encouraging anyone with information on Saeed Ibrahim to get in touch with authorities. Police are guarding Saeed Ibrahim's family, fearing possible revenge attacks on them.
Now, there has been considerable debate in London and throughout Britain after the shooting of the young Brazilian man on a train in South London last week. I understand you visited the Stockwell community where he lived and where much of the investigation has been focused. How are people there reacting to the shooting?
It hit that community in particular pretty hard. It's a very diverse community of immigrants. Over 150 languages are spoken there. They pride themselves on being a very tight-knit neighborhood. And they called a meeting on Sunday night to talk about what the ramifications of the shooting has been that happened in their backyard, in their tube station, the Stockwell subway station. And the police are taking the community response very seriously. They sent their number two officer from the Metropolitan Police to interface with community members at that meeting and to be a public face of the police and to hear their concerns. Religious leaders were there from the community. One Muslim leader talked about feeling targeted and vulnerable to armed plainclothes police who are operating on a so-called shoot-to-kill policy. He said he felt that there were reverberations throughout the Muslim community there of people feeling afraid and not knowing what they're to do when plainclothes police officers approach them, as they did Jean-Charles de Menezes, who was shot, as you mentioned in the lead, mm-hmm. seven times.
Obviously, if police are looking for information about possible terrorists within the Muslim community, they need help from the Muslim community. At the same time, they may be alienating those people.
It's true. They very much have made a point of saying that they need the community's help and cooperation in the investigation. They say time and time again that they're trying to be inclusive and incorporating community leaders from all different communities, but particularly the Muslim community. And they're really trying to reach out. They've attended community meetings, and they're trying to gauge reaction to events within these communities. And they're working to preserve those relations as at the same time these communities are coming forward and saying that they feel targeted and are concerned that this shoot-to-kill policy in recent events puts them in jeopardy, and they are definitely feeling the effects of recent events.
As mentioned, there may be additional news on the arrests today in Britain. Stay tuned to NPR for further details as they emerge. Rachel Martin, thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil.
NPR's Rachel Martin joined us from our studios in London. Roger Blitz is UK Affairs Editor for the Financial Times. He joins us now from that newspaper's office in London, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks a lot.
Sir Ian Blair, the Commissioner of London's Metropolitan Police, said yesterday that officers have almost used the shoot-to-kill policy seven times since the July 7th bombings. Perhaps in the course of today's arrest in Birmingham, they may have considered using it again. Do we know when this policy was enacted?
This policy was enacted in 2003 in considerable secrecy. It was a policy that appears to have been developed on the advice of Israeli military police, who have been important also in giving advice about the where potential suicide bombers should be shot. It had been, for example, the practice of the British police to shoot to the chest. What we now saw with the unfortunate killing of Jean-Charles de Menezes was that he was, shot repeatedly in the head. And this is part of the advice that's been given out by the Israelis to the British police, and that obviously has been around for a couple of years now.
As we heard in Rachel Martin's conversation, a taser was used to restrain the man today in Birmingham. Does that suggest this policy's under review?
Well, every event in this investigation is pointing to one review or another.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does. One can speculate ad nauseam. I suppose one can argue that the police might argue that they had sufficient information to know that he was not carrying, not wearing anything. I mean, the raid appeared to have taken place at a home in the middle of the night. So maybe he was actually in bed. So all of these things are there to be speculated on. I mean, clearly, the other important thing is that there are three suspects out there, and if as we expect, this is one of the four, then the information that he is able to give to the police in finding the other three is also critical. So that may also account for why a stun gun was used.
If they'd also evacuated the immediate vicinity, 100 houses in the area, the threat to civilians may have been reduced as well. So anyway, we're going to continue with this conversation when we come back from a short break and take your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, back after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about police tactics in the age of terror, what police departments are learning, and how comfortable the public is with new and potentially lethal strategies. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with Miami's chief of police about new tactics he's encountered. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. Our guest is Roger Blitz. He's UK Affairs Editor for the Financial Times. And I also wanted to ask you about political reaction to this. How significant is it that Ken Livingstone, the left-wing mayor of London, considerably to the left of Tony Blair, has thus far upheld the police actions in this case?
I think every politician is desperately wanting this investigation to be successful, and also desperately wants it to be successful quickly. This is obviously a time of anxiety, and whatever political colour you come from, you are probably likely to suspend judgment until there is clarity over the investigation. I don't think one should read too much in the silence, otherwise, of politicians towards this. I mean, there will be questions asked. I mean, one key investigation that is another investigation is going to be taking place is obviously of the killing by mistake of this Brazilian electrician, and there we expect that to be a very, very difficult investigation for the Met Police.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Suresh. Suresh calling from Fort Lauderdale in Florida.
Thanks, Neil, for taking my question.
Sure.
My question is that in Sri Lanka and in Israel, which use the shoot-to-kill policy, they seem to have been successful with it. That's why the English have adapted it. Does anybody know how their success rate is?
We looked at this question about how other countries adopted it. I think I can't tell you that much about Sri Lanka, but the Israeli policy has had a fair number of mistakes. They are not terribly, they don't make international news, but it is always going to be a fail-safe measure, and I don't think any country that adopts it expects it to be so either. I mean, it's also used in Russia, which has obviously suffered from suicide bombers and obviously the Beslan siege. And the U.S. has policies which I think varies from state to state, in which federal agents can shoot to kill in order to defend their own lives. European countries are broadly, have actually adopted shoot-to-kill policies much more quickly than the U.K., but the U.K. has been a country which has prided itself on having unarmed officers on the streets. Perhaps that scenario is going to change.
It's also about the effectiveness of it. The idea, presumably, is to keep hands away from the trigger, but aren't, in some cases, these bombs wired with a dead man switch? If you let go of something, they go off.
I can't say for that, but what I can say is that there is a procedure, a chain of decision-making that takes place under this shoot-to-kill policy in the UK, in which officers have to get authorization from a senior commander who is linked to them electronically and can give a go order in seconds. Now, that is a very cautious, I think is a very cautious shoot-to-kill policy compared to other countries. But every country is going to have a different experience of dealing with a suicide bomber, and Israel, I think, quite clearly is going to be have the more experience than anybody else.
Thanks very much for the call, Suresh.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Peter. Peter calling from Hallandale in Florida.
Oh, yes. Good afternoon. I think, actually, my point has just been briefly touched on. But the point I did want to make, as a Brit, been living here for 7 years, having not lived in England for the last, 32 years, but remained very much in touch with what's going on, nevertheless, I did want to make the point, which has been raised by several of my American friends and many times. They said, well, your police don't carry guns. So how do they manage to enforce the law without carrying guns? And I said, well, to my knowledge, the deterrent was that the retribution would be so sudden and horrific if the robbers go around shooting British policemen, that in itself seems to be the deterrent in itself.
Well, there were also many fewer criminals with guns as a result of gun control policies in Britain. Isn't that right, Roger Blitz?
Well, I think that there is simply the gun culture, whether you are the police or whether you, dare I say it, whether you're of the criminal fraternity, is to avoid using it at all costs. Having said that, there are 400 trained firearms officers in the London police force, and actually there were 15,000 incidents that they were assigned to just last year. Mm-hmm. So the police are used to having firearms officers attending scenes where they think there is a threat or a danger to life. In actual fact, they only opened fire on 20 occasions. So that all adds up to the desire to avoid a gun culture on the streets of London at all costs.
Peter, thanks very much for the call.
Well,
let's go now to Kathleen. Kathleen calling from Washington, D.C.
Hi there, Neil. How are you?
Very well.
Neil, let me just say this to you. I'm an anthropologist, and one of the problems, this is truly where the expression penny wise and pound foolish comes in. Number one, if the police had been thinking about doing something like this and come to the communities and brought the imams together up front, ahead of the curve, and said, this is a way that we are going to take information from the Israelis since they've done this kind of thing. And we want to make sure that there are no misunderstandings and that you're at the table when we think about putting this in play. I can guarantee you that many people in these communities would have, there'd be some issues, but they would have come together, at least they would have known what was going on. Now what you've got is a mess on your hands because there's no apology. There's still this cavalier, we regret it deeply, but we haven't apologized for it. So that's a level of arrogance. Then you've got the whole idea of the community finding out that they've got secret goings on with the Israelis, which you know how that looks. So once again, you know, the authorities always believe that they're going to do something up front, and then they come running to people in the community later on down the line begging, oh, please help us, when those people could have helped them way up front in advance.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Thank you for the call, Kathleen. The secrecy here is an issue, Roger Blitz.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue. It's an issue about the secrecy of communities, about how government and police try to avoid, you know, talking openly about these things. I mean, they would argue that you need that secrecy in order to create to avoid a fear factor. I mean, had you had, you know, in 2003, the British government saying, right, we've got a shoot to kill policy, you know, that would have been a much more difficult thing for the government to try and sell in a time of relative normality, in a time of considerable anxiety. Coming out and saying there's a shoot to kill policy actually after, you know, an event happens, makes people feel, well, you know, perhaps at least the police is doing something. There is secrecy around, and I think that your caller's point about you know, the amount of knowledge that we all have about all our communities in London is not good enough, and I think that is going to be one of the lessons to be learned out of this, is that our security intelligence, our police intelligence about these individuals within a very, very large and largely peaceful and was totally peaceful community has been lacking. What one really does about that in terms of how one actually goes about and infiltrating into people's private lives and communities is very difficult. We are talking about religious organizations. We are talking about their rights to come together and to pray and not to be hounded for doing so. And I think that what we have is, you know, one liberty against another liberty, and it's difficult. It's going to take time for all that to unravel.
Roger Blitz, thanks very much for being with us this evening.
Okay.
Roger Blitz is a UK affair editor for the Financial Times. He's with us from his office in London, and we are hearing that, in fact, there will not be, as we mentioned earlier, a news conference by the Metropolitan Police in London today. So as more details become available, we'll report them here on NPR News. Joining us now is John Timoney. He's the chief of police in Miami, Florida, and recently returned from a seminar in England and Scotland with long sessions on the quandary of what to do about suicide bombers. He's with us from his office in Miami. Chief Timoney, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
What was the discussion like? This was presumably before this incident last week.
It was exactly about 10 days before the first incident in London. And this is not the first time we've discussed this whole issue of suicide bombers. You know, it's been perplexing why we in the West have never really experienced it, with the exception, obviously, of 9/11, but that was a different type. But the usual suicide bombers, the things you see in Israel on a daily basis, you know, in Iraq, why haven't we seen it here? Well, guess what? It looks like we may have, in the case of London, seen it on the 7th. Although I'm still not quite sure. I've spoken to some people over there, and there are some indications. Early on, there were indications that there was definite suicide bombers. However, there are three or four inexplicable things that stand out that say maybe they weren't suicide bombers. Maybe they were just dupes.
So people who did not know that they were carrying bombs?
That's correct. You know, why would all four purchase round-trip tickets? And then the Jamaica fella, he parked his car and had a 7-day pass.
Mm-hmm.
There was more explosives in the back of his car. which would indicate, you know, getting ready to do another mission if the first one was successful, then the whole idea of not leaving a note to a family member or creating a video or going on the internet or a chat room, you know, explaining why they were doing it. And then there were one or two other, which I can't remember offhand, that would normally be indicative of a suicide bomber that were absent. And so that brings up a whole other thing. Maybe there's this great mastermind behind the whole plot.
We are talking with John Timoney. He's the chief of police in Miami, Florida, about what to do about the threat of suspected suicide bombers. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As you thought about and looked into these questions, Chief Timoney, what's your policy there in Miami?
Well, the policy here is the same as much of America. Our very first defense against suicide bombers or any kind of bomber is the whole notion of getting good intelligence on the ground. That is a key to success. The second part is, you know, where we can and when we can afford it, having a strong police presence, usually a uniform presence. We know for a fact that they do that it does work. It does deter individuals.
Mm-hmm.
We know of at least two cases that we can document in New York, including the Brooklyn Bridge, where a guy went to case it, an Al-Qaeda member went to case the Brooklyn Bridge, and then reported back to his handlers that it was too hot, that the cops were all over the place.
Yeah, but what do you do in the extremity? Someone has slipped through. Your police believe the man has a bomb strapped around his body. He's in a crowd. What do you do?
Well, that's, you know, right now, We've not been confronted with that. My sense is, just like London, it'll probably there will be a need, not a need, but when the first suicide bomber hits any American city, I think you will see the shooting policies of American police departments, the big city police departments. I think you'll see them change. Right now, all across America, the policies are pretty similar from city to city.
Mm-hmm.
Training is the same, where we shoot not to kill, but to stop. We train our police officers to shoot for the upper torso. It's the biggest target. And we know for a fact that it may not kill somebody right away or ever, it does in fact stop them. In the case of the suicide bomber, though, that's a problem. The idea that a person, a suicide bomber in this case, just needs to turn a switch. It's a matter of a second.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a need to, unfortunately, these are grotesque and graphic terms, to take that person out immediately. And the only thing we know that will work in that regard are headshots. I mean, a shot to the head. This is what the Israeli police train on. This is what they've been confronted with over the years. And so ideally, these things resolve themselves as they do in Israel, where you can confront somebody, give them certain orders and make them disrobe and take the bomb off. But if there's any hesitation, then I think police officers are compelled. Again, we assume they know it's a suicide bomber.
Mm-hmm.
Compelled to take the headshot. It's not something we relish. It's not something we look forward to. It's one of the unfortunately necessary evils emanating out of this whole suicide bomber problem.
Who decides on the policy? Is it you as a chief of police? Is it the mayor, the governor, the Department of Homeland Security?
The chief of police. Now, by the way, we already have a policy like that in effect in most cities. For example, but it's limited to sharpshooters, to usually certain members of the SWAT teams. For example, I can remember in New York probably about 10 or 15 years ago, where a man had taken some children hostage, and I believe injured, and was clearly going to kill these children. And he kind of ducked out of a back window and a fire escape. And the chief, the ranking officer at the scene, ahead of time had designated one police officer, if you get a shot at him, take him out. And in that situation, he was taken out. And so the SWAT team members, on a regular basis, have this type of training. There's one or two designated shooters in each team, in each city, that, God forbid, they've got to take somebody out, then they take them out. But when you're faced with a suicide bomber, sometimes you don't have the luxury or the availability of a SWAT team. that you're confronted in the downtown area. And so there will need to be training, if you will, for the average police officer. And that becomes a bit of a problem.
Chief Timoney, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Okay.
John Timoney is chief of police for the city of Miami in Florida, and he joined us from his offices there. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our discussion of police tactics against terrorism, and we'll take a look at a wider Valerie Plame investigation. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about how police forces in the U.S. are learning to combat the threat of suicide bombers. Could something similar to last week's shooting of an innocent man in Britain happen here? Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now is Jeffrey Ian Ross, a criminologist from the University of Baltimore, focused on policing in the United States. He's the author of Making News of Police Violence, and he joins us from his home here in Washington, D.C. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
Good. We just heard from the chief of police in Miami how that city is dealing with the possibility of a suicide bomber. Is that typical of other police departments around the country?
Well, I think police departments across the United States, particularly the large ones, big cities where there's a possibility of a terrorist incident, are exploring the possibility of having, if they don't have already some sort of a terrorist, anti-terrorist unit, they're typically pretty small, and the chiefs of police are worried that they may be unnecessarily labeled, you know, Red Squad, like they were operating back in the 1960s or even earlier, to say the Palmer raids.
Mm-hmm. Who decides how a police department prepares for terrorism? Is it the chief of police? Is it the mayor? Is it the Department of Homeland Security? Who decides?
I think it's a combination of people. Most well-intentioned and, I guess, in-touch chiefs of police are in consultation with their communities, with their mayor. The mayor is in contact with state planners, and they talk about this sort of thing. A lot of it depends on potential threat, money available, who's going to pay the bill, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to get any money from Homeland Security or any sort of support from Homeland Security, what kind of support they're going to get from Homeland Security. It's a complicated sort of decision-making process.
As Chief Timoney suggested, though, when push comes to shove, it's likely to be not the special anti-terrorist unit or even the SWAT unit that gets involved here, but just a regular frontline cop.
Yeah, well, what happens is, you know, police are often the first line responders, they have to make split second decisions. And this is the recent terrorist bombings in London and the shoot to kill policy in London brings all these kinds of questions to a head, and also the discussion on police use of force and how that's changing in the United States over the past 25, 30 years, and it has changed. And it should change. We can talk about that if you want.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just had the case out in Los Angeles recently of a SWAT team that accidentally killed a toddler who was being used as a human shield by her father. That raises, again, the question of the use of force.
Well, you know, most definitely. I mean, over the past 25 years, police use of force has changed based on a number of Supreme Court cases and incidents which have taken place in the United States that have gotten a lot of bad publicity for the police, and where the police have lost money in civil cases. Going back as far as 1985 in Garner versus Tennessee, where after that police officers were instructed not to shoot an individual unless that person posed a danger to himself or other people. We moved. So what happened after that was we had the Rodney King incident.
Mm-hmm.
We saw unnecessary police violence or overuse of force, and so police departments started using what's known as a continuum of force in their training, simply stated that the police should not use any more force than is necessary to subdue an individual or to redirect that individual. We had the Columbine high school shootings, back in 99. And since 99, a lot of police tactical training has changed dramatically because a couple of things. One is about 15 families sued the police jurisdiction in Columbine. And secondly, in a review of the incident, it was discovered that the almost all of the victims were killed or injured within the first, 20 minutes. And what had happened was the police responded very quickly to the incident, about 5 minutes after the, there was a call of shots fired. But it took a good about 45 minutes before the SWAT team went in. And in a review of that incident, it was determined that had the first responders, the officers that showed up right away, would have gone in, that quite possibly lives would have been saved if those officers went in right away rather than waiting for not only the SWAT team, but the numerous police that showed up to the incident. So what's happening now is there has been a change in policies and practices in the United States, irrespective of suicide bombers. And police officers in hostage-type situations are now more prone to take the person out if they can get a clear shot. And I think that kind of training, that kind of disposition or policy is flowing into the response to suicide bombers.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Rui. Am I getting that right, in Las Vegas?
Yes, sir.
Yes, go ahead. Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
My name is Rui. I served 4 years in the anti-terror forces of the Israeli military, and now I'm a member of the American society. And I would like to make a comment on what worked for us in Israel. I'm sure your guest is aware of that. There's three levels that I want to just mention. One is, and the most important one, as I see it, was intelligence. We learned more how to pick the intelligence up using paid informants within the Muslim populations in the territories where the danger came from. Those informants actually led our anti-terror forces to go and try and apprehend the bomb makers, because once you wait to the level where the cop in the street is your line of defense, you're a little bit too late, because what happened was, for example, in Israel, in the attempt of two British citizens to blow up the American embassy, they saw the security forces in front of the embassy, and all they did is turn around, walk into the next bar, and blew the bar. What the cops can do is deter the suicide bomber from going to his maybe prime target, but they do not stop him from causing the havoc and damage and killing innocent people.
Mm-hmm. Yet, as you mentioned, obviously intelligence, and Chief Timoney mentioned this as well earlier, that's a key, and obviously you want to stop these things before they get to that point, but in Israel, as we saw in London, sometimes intelligence doesn't work.
I agree. Intelligence involves taking away freedoms. And in our Western societies, as soon as our freedom is touched, there's a big call and voice of anger of people saying that, hey, you should not take our freedom and you should not invade our privacy. But then in Israel, we have this attitude where life is sacred and comes before everything else. And if we do have to take away some rights of some people in order to stop them from committing crimes, then that's a choice. It's a hard choice to make, and it's a very moral hard choice to make.
And we may have to be making more of them. Rui, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted to get your response to that, Jeffrey. Ian Ross?
Well, I think what the caller has to say is important. One of the problems with municipal police forces is that they have historically been the sort of the poor cousins in the sort of intelligence, national security framework of Western societies, and the United States is not not excluded here. Most chiefs of police and mayors have been lobbying since 9/11 to get more money for a variety of purposes, from Homeland Security, not just for reactive sorts of things like bomb detectors or robots that can dismantle bombs or x-ray machines that are portable, that sort of thing. But they want money to do more intelligence-related things. The problem is, I think, that departments, including the Homeland Security, are very reluctant to give police departments for money to collect intelligence, though intelligence is collected if there's a criminal connection there. Mm-hmm. Gathering better intelligence and making sure one has informers, and that's always been a problem. Cultivating appropriate informants in the community.
You mentioned concerns about being tarred as a Red Squad again. Jeffrey Ian Ross, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Ian Ross is a criminologist at the University of Baltimore, and he joined us from his home in Washington, D.C. Coming up, an inquiry into the leak of a CIA agent's identity expands into claims about weapons of mass destruction. That's next.